Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. It's The Show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, the new chair of the state Democratic Party on recovering from a disappointing 2024. And what's next for the Phoenix Suns after a disappointing season for them? But first, President Trump late Friday signed a presidential memo that will allow the U.S. military to patrol a swath of land in New Mexico along the border with Mexico and arrest migrants they encounter there. And if it's successful, the plan is to expand the operation along the entire border from New Mexico west to California. The memo hands the public land over to the Defense Department and makes it part of an Army base. But the entire plan is likely to face legal challenges. With me to talk through this is Tara Kopp, Defense Department correspondent for the Associated Press. And Tara, what exactly is the Defense Department doing on the southern border here?
Sure. Well, it took a couple of days to figure that out, actually. The order came in late Friday night, and, you know, Monday, the Defense Department was still trying to figure out and is still trying to figure out now, what are the legal issues here? What does it mean for troops? The order that the executive order Trump signed basically establishes this long sliver of federal land known as the Roosevelt Reservation. It was set aside in 1907, right along the U.S.-Mexico border, so that there was basically a buffer zone along the entire border where there wouldn't be development. There are a couple exceptions to this. If there are tribal lands, the Roosevelt Reservation doesn't go through those tribal lands. The border between Texas and Mexico is also exempt because Texas joined the U.S. as an independent country in 1845, and so was exempted from this Roosevelt Reservation. But basically, it's a really, if you think about it, it's only 60 feet wide. It's just a buffer zone. It was meant to, you know, make sure that right along the U.S.-Mexico border, there weren't going to be buildings, there weren't going to be impediments if you do need areas that have a border fence.
So you mentioned that the Defense Department is still trying to figure some of this stuff out. Like, what are the questions that the Pentagon is trying to get answers to still?
Sure. So the whole reason that President Trump signed this was that his administration looks at this as a way to get around posse comitatus, which is a federal law that prohibits troops under federal control from conducting civilian law enforcement on domestic soil. Now, there are a couple exceptions to this. If troops are, you know, say in an emergency situation, hurricane response, something like that, where they accidentally or not accidentally, but have to do some sort of law enforcement, but is not the main purpose of their being there, they can do that. So the Trump administration has figured out that if they just turn this long swath of land from the Department of Interior, who currently owns it, to the Department of Defense, and then the Department of Defense says, okay, this land is actually now part of a military base. So for the next 45 days, there's going to be a small kind of test case in New Mexico where part of the Roosevelt Reservation right along the border is going to be made part of Fort Huachuca, which is an Arizona Army base. Now, if you've ever been to an Army base or any military installation, there's a gate. There are security guards. You can't just walk on to the military base. And that's the idea here, is that if someone just kind of walked on to this area, say a migrant crossing the border illegally and encountered U.S. troops along that reservation, they could detain that migrant because they're trespassing on a military facility. There's still some questions about this as to whether or not it can actually be done, because the executive order really was establishing this swath of land specifically for border control, border protection. And the kind of exception that allows U.S. troops to be able to do civilian law enforcement is supposed to be on an emergency case only. It's not supposed to be that they can do law enforcement because it's now their primary mission of this little swath of land. So legal experts I talked to yesterday said that this is still kind of shaky territory and is likely to be challenged in the courts.
Well, President Trump, though, has said that this is an emergency situation, hasn't he?
Yes, but so the there's an emergency situation like a hurricane, there's an emergency situation like border control. The US troops can't be used as their primary mission to do law enforcement for border control, even under this kind of special case scenario, because they basically the exemption that allows them to do this is called the military purpose doctrine, which means if they happen to be doing something like helping out after a severe hurricane and there's looting or there's something where a crime is being committed and the troops are the only ones there who can react, they can act as civilian law enforcement for a very limited specific amount of time, and
Okay.
they turn over those people to then actual civilian law enforcement. They can't have their primary mission along the border be to be patrolling and being able to detain and arrest migrants as they cross the border.
So, in the Trump administration's imagining of this scenario, if a military member arrests a border crosser, what do they do with that person then?
So the idea right now is if they do come across migrants, they would be able to arrest them and then immediately turn them over to whatever law enforcement agency is there on the ground, whether that's Customs and Border Protection, whether that's, a local sheriff's office. Again, this still, there still needs to be some kind of vetting of this, I'm sure. And the experts that I talked to are also sure that this will probably be immediately challenged by lawyers representing those migrants who are detained.
So you mentioned that, obviously most military bases have gates and guards and other security. Is the plan to build any of that on this sliver of land, or is it just declared an army base and, it is, even though it doesn't look like one?
Yes, there are plans in this 45-day test case and kind of this limited part of the Roosevelt Reservation to put up signage, issue warnings, to put up some additional fencing and see if that is an effective deterrent.
Has this ever been tried before?
To my knowledge, this has not been tried before. The Roosevelt Reservation has been used as in the past to allow for border protection. For example, in the early 2000s and even during Trump's first term, when they were putting up the border wall, because the Roosevelt Reservation was owned by the Department of Interior, they were allowed to, construct things along that path as long as they were conscientious of some environmental concerns. And the fact that this was a 60-foot swath of land that was federal assisted in the construction of, if you remember, there were sections of the wall that were put up during
Yeah.
Trump's first term. And so this isn't the first time that the administration has considered the use of the Roosevelt Reservation, but it is the first time that I can recall that they have used it in a way that they think will allow troops to basically patrol it as they would their own military base. This really represents the biggest expansion of the Trump's administration's use of the military to conduct border protection, border control, not only during his first term, but now. In the past, you had troops assigned to help with the border wall, like unroll concertina wire, help get the wall up, fill in some of the back administrative jobs to allow the border agents to actually conduct the law enforcement activities at the border. We've seen in his first 100 days in office, it's expanded slightly. So the Air Force has been flying a lot of military air flights to return migrants who've been deported to their home countries or to send them to the naval facility at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. But now you're talking about actually having troops on the ground that might be conducting civilian law enforcement.
All right. That is Tara Kopp, Pentagon correspondent with the Associated Press. Tara, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
The U.S. House and Senate are expected to soon begin work on trying to find common ground on a framework for a new budget. The House approved its version last week, which calls for the chamber's Energy and Commerce Committee to find ways to cut roughly $880 billion. That committee has jurisdiction over Medicare and Medicaid, among other programs. And while Republican leaders have said Medicaid will not see cuts, many experts say it's not possible to cut that amount without including the health care program for low-income Americans. Medicaid has been around since 1965, although Arizona was the last state in the country to start its program. It launched the Arizona Health Care Cost Containment System, or ACCCESS, in 1982. Last month on the show, we heard from the head of the Arizona Hospital and Healthcare Association, who estimated 750,000 Arizonans could lose their healthcare coverage if the feds implement cuts to Medicaid. Today, we hear a historical perspective on the program from Len Kirshner. He served as the second director of Access starting in the mid-1980s and as a past president of AARP Arizona. And he says over the years, there have been a number of political battles over Medicaid.
What's interesting about Medicaid is it's never gotten any positive response from policymakers. It's always been the other child. And so every time there's been a problem in our healthcare system that nobody could figure out what to do about, it was always Medicaid that came to the rescue. When it was clear that Medicaid did not provide long-term care, it became Medicaid's problem. During the AIDS epidemic in the 80s, nobody decided what to do about that population. Medicaid came to the. And when we had a large number of people uninsured in the Obama plan, Medicaid expansion came to the aid. What was interesting was that Jan Brewer was the governor at the time, and she signed a law that made the expansion here. Mm-hmm. A lot of her Republican friends were not happy with that. COVID, massive expansion of Medicaid, and now we're sitting here in 2025, the population of over 2 million covered in the state and almost 80 million covered nationally.
When Arizona decided to start Access, did it learn lessons or had it taken things from other states to incorporate here? Or did Arizona sort of say, this is what we want to do, forget about what anyone else is doing, this is what we think is best here?
Arizona said, we are not going to call it Medicaid. We're going to call it something else. We don't use the word Medicaid, and we're going to do something very different. Medicaid was a fiscal agent. They paid claims after the service was provided. And the Arizona model was a prepaid capitated system with the state contracting with health plans. That was a totally new model. And the first national Medicaid program I went to was in Washington in 1987. And the other Medicaid program state directors all were looking at me and saying, what in the world are you doing? That's not what Medicaid is. Hmm. Since then, almost every state in the country has adopted the Arizona model. We became the model for America.
When Access first started in the early 80s, like what kind of impact did you see off the bat? Like, was it apparent that this is something that the state had needed right away?
No. In fact, the first couple of years was a disaster. First of all, it started out, it was a division of the Department of Health Services. It wasn't a separate state agency. And they contracted out McGarda Systems, which was a subsidiary of an aerospace company. The first 2 years did not work well. The governor decided it needed to be a separate state agency. And in 1984, became a separate state agency, and Don Schaller came in as the first director. When Babbitt left to run for president, we got a new governor, Evan Neacom. I became the next director. And the program has evolved over time. It moved from a totally new system that was hard to start to now we're the national model.
So I guess what changed? I mean, I would imagine that just moving it to its own state agency, its sort of separate entity, wasn't all that happened to turn that around, right?
No, it required building a new information system because what McGarda had brought in a retrospective payment system from New York State. It didn't work because those were paying claims after the fact, a month or two after it was provided. The Arizona model was to pay capitation upfront, the start of the month, provide care. And it took us about 4 years to build a new system, the prepaid medical management information system. And we spent about close to $50 million on building that information technology.
When you look at Access today, you referenced how it's sort of always been, you know, sort of coming to the rescue when you have a population of people that need healthcare and you don't know where else for them to get it. Access has sort of been there. When you look at Access today in 2025, like what is its impact? What is its importance to Arizona?
Well, over 2 million of the 7 million people in Arizona are covered by Access. Half the women who give birth in the state are on Access at the time of delivery. About 65 to 70% of the children in the state are unaccessed. Over 50% of the seniors who are in long-term care are unaccessed. You cut back funding for this program has a major impact on healthcare in this state, particularly in the rural areas, but certainly throughout Arizona. And of course, that's what the federal government is talking about doing. They're talking about cutting spending by $880 billion over the next 10 years. Most of that will come from Medicaid. And if that happens, we could see 600,000 people with healthcare coverage on the Access Program lose coverage right out of the gate.
So what happens then if there are cuts? I mean, is this the kind of thing where the state, in your mind, has to backfill that and pick up the cost for those patients? Or do those patients just maybe lose health care and become uncompensated care for hospitals?
I think that you're going to find many of them become uncompensated care. They don't have access to other health care programs. If the first thing that happens is they cut back on the funding for the expansion population that Jan Brewer signed into law, 600,000 people on the program. There's a trigger that says if the funding goes below 80% of the cost, with the state picking up more, then the funding system that we have in Arizona goes away, and that population will probably lose coverage. Hmm. That will increase the number of people who are uninsured in the state.
And, I mean, it sounds as though, as you said, the way that this is being proposed anyway, the talk right now, would not, in your mind, have a good outcome for the state and perhaps more importantly for the people who are on access, who rely on it to get health care.
It's going to have a terrible outcome if they go forward with the things that are being rumored coming out of Washington, D.C. right now.
Len Kirshner served as the second director of the Arizona Healthcare Cost Containment System, or ACCESS, Arizona's Medicaid program. He's also an Air Force veteran and past president of AARP Arizona. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, some historical context for the teen mental health issues dramatized in the Netflix series Adolescence. But first, the NBA's play-in tournament begins today. The rest of the postseason gets underway on Saturday. The Phoenix Suns, despite having the highest payroll in league history, will not be a part of either. The Suns ended the season 36-46 in 11th place in the Western Conference. And yesterday, the team fired its head coach, Mike Budenholzer, after one season on the job. He'd followed Frank Vogel, who also only lasted 1 year as head coach. With me now to talk about what's next for the Valley's original sports franchise is Brad Sesmat, CEO of Sports360AZ.com. Hey there, Brad.
Mark, how are you?
Doing all right. I think I'm doing a little bit better than the Suns right now. So, like, what's going on over there?
What's the whole hour? No, we don't. Here's the thing. They're now paying three coaches. They're going to hire a fourth coach. So they're going to have four coaches on payroll. Matt Ishbia has come in, and the mortgage industry, as we know, is not doing as well as it once was doing when he took over. So I'm wondering behind the scenes what's going on the business side. You have Devin Booker saying it's been a slow bleed out, which that was his quote, and that's not good because he has a couple of years left on his deal. And I think the big question mark is this another bottoming out of the Suns franchise? We went through the decade of decline, as I call, from 2010 to 2020, where it was just misery all over the place. But now you have to wonder, if you're going to trade Kevin Durant, and it's been out there now that Durant's people and the Suns are saying they're going to work a deal to get him out of here. Okay, then do you keep Devin Booker, who has 2 years left on his deal, or do you tear this thing all the way down to the ground and get together so many draft picks, so much asset, that you can rebuild and have a long, long run, but are fans willing to do that?
Well, that seems like a really interesting question. And Brad, I've read, I'm sure you've read as well, there's some national basketball writers who are saying that really the only way out of this for the Suns is to trade Devin Booker. He's the only player who will land them the young players and draft picks that will help them rebuild. But at the same time, he is sort of the face of the franchise. He's the franchise's all-time leading scorer. Can you envision a universe in which Matt Ishbia would actually trade Devin Booker?
Well, I think we're going to know more this summer on that question, Mark, because Booker's eligible to sign a 2-year, $150 million extension this summer. And I expect the Suns are going to make that offer to him. But is there going to be any pullback at all? So we're going to know the direction. And so far, just look at this owner. I think it's fair to say Matt Ishbia has been a ready, fire, aim owner so far. Let's go get Bradley Beal and give him a contract in which Bradley Beal sits in a locker room with a losing team and stares into cameras and microphones and confidently says, "I own all the cards." If that quote doesn't make fans sick of what's going on in pro sports at times, we don't want to hear that here in Arizona. What we are used to using, seeing, and hearing is it's about the team. The last time a guy threatened to want out of here was Charles, when Charles said, "I've been treated like a piece of meat," by Jerry Colangelo, his famous quote, if you remember that one. So, can I see a universe? Sure, I can. Would it be the right move to make? It depends on what you want. Mark, if he's a businessman only owner, then he's going to be concerned about the lower bowl, selling tickets, television contracts, and public backlash of Devin Booker. If he's about winning, then I can make the argument you should listen to all offers, including if it's the number one pick in the draft this year in Cooper Flagg and you have to trade Devin Booker. You do it. You absolutely have to do it because now you're set up for another 10-year run. So there's scenarios that are easy for you and I to talk about, play ping pong on today here in April. But I think we're going to know a lot more in the next 60 days about what direction this owner wants to go.
Interesting. So, Brad, I mentioned that the Suns are looking for yet another head coach. Given where the team is being head coach of the Phoenix Suns a desirable job?
It's a great question, and I would say that there's always somebody who thinks it would be because they're going to want to know, do I have Devin Booker to work with, or am I going to be micromanaged from above? Remember, let's just look at who's been in the circles of Matt Ishbia. Isaiah Thomas sitting with him in his suite. That was caught. People wrote about it, talked about it. He's very close with Tom Izzo at Michigan State. There's some layers here to this story, Mark, that I think everybody's looking at the what happened, what went wrong with Coach Bud. I'm more along the lines of what's going on with the owner behind the scenes, because so far, when you own a sports franchise, it's a public trust. We trust the owner. So far, you look at this owner and say, "Yeah, a lot of money. I don't care about lots of money. What I care about is winning." And yeah, the two go together. I get it. But when it's a public trust, you don't take this thing and run it into the ditch like what we're looking at right now. As you said, right off the top, biggest payroll in the history of the league. They don't even make the playoffs. In fact, they don't even sniff the play-in game with Kevin Durant and Devin Booker. Completely inexcusable.
Well, so Brad, we have about a minute or so left, and the phrase that I keep hearing is new owner syndrome with Matt Ishbia. He comes in and immediately makes the trade for Kevin Durant. He then fires a head coach. He trades for Bradley Beal. He's now fired another head coach. Is Matt Ishbia part of the problem here?
Well, if he is, it's not going to get fixed because he's now been given control. We can go back to Robert Sarver, when Robert took over with the Suns, and Robert brought in a guy named Steve Kerr as a consultant, and Steve got out of here, and the Suns almost had Steph Curry rather than Amar'e Stoudemire. I mean, you could go back through the history and say, was it the owner's fault? Was it all Jerry that the Suns had such great success? No, Cotton Fitzsimmons was behind him. Other people were behind him. I don't know if Matt has a deep group of people invested in Phoenix or if they're just invested in, hey, we're cool. We own an NBA team. There's a lot of that this day and age in pro sports.
That's interesting. All right, lots to follow coming up. That is Brad Sesmat, CEO of Sports360AZ.com. Brad, great as always to talk to you. Thank you.
Anytime, Mark.
On March 27th, the Trump administration issued an executive order called Restoring Truth and Sanity to American History. The order alleged a, quote, concerted and widespread effort to rewrite our nation's history. In the administration's framing, there is a subversive movement underway to undermine America's legacy as racist, sexist, oppressive, or otherwise irredeemably flawed. To support its claim, the order cites, among other things, an exhibition at the Smithsonian called The Shape of Power: Stories of Race in American Sculpture. According to the Smithsonian's website, the show, which is on view until September of this year, explores the ways that sculpture has shaped the way generations have learned to visualize and think about race. Nicholas Galanin is an indigenous sculptor whose work appears in the show, and my co-host Sam Dingman spoke with him recently. They began by discussing Galanin's piece, which is called The Imaginary Indian Totem Pole.
It's a carved totem pole that has been made in Indonesia for commercial market, and the totem disappears, or nearly disappears, into an expanse of floral wallpaper. The work speaks towards indigenous culture, commodified by and for non-indigenous communities.
Yeah. So am I hearing you right that the totem itself was pre-existing, or did you carve it?
No. You know, I was trained as a totem carver in my community, and I still do that work.
Okay.
I didn't carve this totem. When I say Indonesian carved, the Indonesian carvers who are hired, they're working for less pay, cheaper labor.
Right.
And they're hired by people not from our community to replicate or to, you know, fetishize or misappropriate our visual language, which is our, in this case, our totems, basically removing indigenous people from the entire process. Through the context and through the process of this work, you know, it becomes indigenous art again.
I see. Yeah. Well, so the Smithsonian that is showing this piece was targeted by an executive order from President Trump, which alleged that the Smithsonian had, quote, come under the influence of a divisive race-centered ideology. And he singled out the exhibition that your piece is part of in particular. That exhibition is called The Shape of Power: Stories of Race in American Sculpture. What did you think when you heard about it?
I mean, I feel like we're built and prepared for a lot as indigenous people. We have survived this nation up to now. And so these things, they don't surprise me. This is in alignment with historical aspects of how our communities have been erased to try to control a narrative. This is something that we've contended with for a long time and we overcome. We're not going to disappear because they decide to disappear words or definitions or versions of history. I know that up at the University of Alaska Anchorage recently, their Native student offices, which is a really important space for Indigenous students to, you know, transition into living in a larger city out of villages or communities, was recently shut down. And we really feel some of this in our communities in certain ways. And even the rollback on, you know, grants I have had. I just had an email yesterday of a project that I was supposed to be doing for a soundtrack on a score for a film, and that was postponed or put on hold or canceled because NEA grants have been, you know, paused, and that project was part of that. So,
Oh, wow. So even if this Smithsonian exhibition remains on view, at least for the moment, you're losing work because of these executive orders in other ways.
Yeah, it goes beyond it. Our community here with Doge, even with the funding that was used to distribute fish to our community, wild caught sustenance, which was fish from our waters by oftentimes indigenous fishermen and processed in our communities. And all of that has, you know, come to a halt. The reach is far.
So you're feeling the impacts of this, it sounds like, in at least three different ways.
In many ways, yes.
Can I ask you, I mean, one of the things that stories like the Smithsonian piece of this bring up, at least in my mind, is a fundamental disagreement between the administration and artists like yourself about the purpose of art, whether it's supposed to affirm the official narrative of the country or challenge it. What do you see as the types of conversations you want a piece like The Imaginary Indian Totem Pole to start?
It's a form of access. It's access to voice, it's access to history, and it can't be erased. And like, it's not our we'll continue on with or without the ability to participate by these institutions. A lot of marginalized communities have fought for a long time to assert truth in a system that's been built on nationalist propaganda. I think art has always been an indicator for health of society in certain ways. And when art is censored or we're dealing with censorship on national or institutional levels, I think it's worthy of raising alarm.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you a little bit more about that, because the justification that the administration has given for a lot of these executive orders is that what they call woke culture has gone too far, that it is out of step with the mainstream of American thought. And that's interesting to me in the context of what you were just saying, and also what you told the New York Times, which is that you said, quote, "When we interrogate systems of power and challenge historical narratives that center whiteness and colonial dominance, we do not divide, we restore balance." So I have the sense that in your framing, work like yours is in service of the same idea of kind of, you know, trying to restore balance to the conversation, but it's the complete opposite point of view for how that needs to happen.
Yeah, all of our stories and our history here as Indigenous artists is the foundation of this place, the land, the politics, and power of sorts, I suppose. So we can't ignore one step of this and really expect to have any kind of story or narrative that's truthful and complete. And an executive order can't really remove art, culture, and memory. Art, culture, and memory has long been tools of resistance, and artists continue to speak truth long after the revisions are forgotten. It won't succeed. It's never the answer.
Censorship, you're saying, is never the answer.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And to do these things is it's a form of struggle for control.
Yeah. Well, Nicholas Glannon is a visual artist and a musician, and his piece, The Imaginary Indian Totem Pole, is part of The Shape of Power, Stories of Race in American Sculpture at the Smithsonian. Nicholas, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Going into November's elections, Arizona Democrats were hopeful of being able to flip one, if not both, chambers of the legislature. Instead, the GOP increased its majorities in both the state House and Senate. In fact, other than now U.S. Senator Ruben Gallego's win, 2024 was not a great electoral year for Democrats in the state. Earlier this year, the party decided to move on from its chair. Despite being endorsed by high-profile elected Democrats like Governor Katie Hobbs and Secretary of State Adrian Fontes, Yolanda Bejarano was defeated by Robert Branscum. Branscum had been a party vice chair. So, after President Trump won Arizona and Democrats lost ground in the legislature, what's next for the party going into next year's midterm elections? Robert Branscum joins me to talk about that, and let me start by asking why you wanted this job.
You know, I get asked that question a lot, and I think it wasn't so much wanting the job, it was so much wanting to do something, to be active and make a change. And I thought at the moment in time, it was an opportunity for me, and I just said, hey, why not?
What do you think this role affords you in terms of being able to do something and affect change that maybe you weren't able to do prior?
I think it affords me to come in with a fresh perspective. You know, I've been active in politics for a while, but I don't consider myself a politician. More of a community activist sort of leader. I come with the mindset that if you see something that needs to be changed or a problem solved, don't wait on someone if you have that ability to go do it. And I believe I had that ability to come make a change.
What kinds of changes do you believe Arizona Democrats need? Because obviously 2024 was not a great year electorally.
2024, we're hoping it's just an anomaly because, you know, as Democrats, we know we are for the people. And I believe that we'd have to reiterate that moving forward. I think some of that messaging got lost last cycle, but our purpose is still the same. We want to stand up for the people, make sure that, you know, human rights, civil rights, health care, jobs, all those things that everyone is concerned with, not just Democrats, but all citizens are concerned with.
Do you have reason to believe that last year was an anomaly? I mean, and I ask because, you know, there have been polls that show, for example, the brand of the Democratic Party is not looking so great right now.
Well, you know, in any championship fight, there's 12 rounds, right? And sometimes the champion gets staggered, but you come back and fight. You know, just I play college sports, and, you know, you don't play a sport to lose. You play a sport to win. And, yes, Democrats, we took a little bit on the chin, but we're not discouraged. We're going to come back because we know that we have the people's best interest in mind. And so we want to make sure that we come back stronger, prepared, learn the lessons of the past, and, you know, get out there and get back into the fight.
So when you talk about maybe some of the messaging not being what it needed to be last year, there's been a lot of talk, and I'm sure you've heard a good amount of it, in terms of maybe the economic message was not on point in terms of understanding why voters, why residents weren't feeling as great about the economy as a lot of Democrats said the economy was doing. Do you buy into that? Do you think that economic messaging played some significant role in the losses last year?
You know, I think we took a hit for that a little bit. I think that we need to be better at explaining and pronouncing what we're doing. You know, I think sometimes we just assume people know it and feel it. But I believe that we can own that messaging because when Democrats are in charge, we always do better. The economy always does better. So we have to make sure we just, you know, toot our horn more. But there is a reality, and people's perception is a reality. And so if the price of eggs are high, you know, we have to do a better way of explaining why they're high.
Are there other issues on which you think the party needs to maybe tweak or make changes larger than tweaks to its messaging?
I believe the party needs to lead to get back and listen to the people, right? I think that's where we kind of lost our way. We have to get our messaging back from the people who needs or need to be met day to day. You know, they will give us that messaging to let us know that, hey, if it's housing costs, if it's education, if it's job security, if it's immigration, you know, they're the ones who are going to be motivated to vote on those ideas. So we have to listen to those people.
Are there particular challenges about sort of playing both offense and defense in the same election? You're defending some seats, and then you're also trying to go on offense and take back others?
Well, they say the best defense is offense.
See, I've heard it the other way.
Well, you know, times have changed. You know, I think we're, you know, there's a time to play defense, but right now we need to be on offense. And the way that things are going in the country, especially with Trump and these tariffs and trying to erase, you know, history, things like that, can't be defensive. You have to take it to them and be on offense.
How unified do you find the party is right now?
The party's unified. I just believe that right now we're in a place that we're organizing and being prepared. So when the time comes, that we go on this and bring the fight to the Republicans.
Do you find that there's sort of a temptation to be sort of the party of not Trump, of not Elon Musk, and not necessarily be for something? Like, is that a trap that you find that Democrats need to be careful of not falling into, especially in a year when Donald Trump is the president but not on the ballot?
We need to be the party of the people. And I say that not to be using a cliche, but we cannot afford to be Republicans, Democrats, independents. We need to be Americans. We need to be Americans because our democracy is on the line right now. It is being torn down before our eyes with this administration.
So if the issue of democracy is one of the issues, I assume there will be others, but one of the issues that Democrats will be talking about, how do you try to make that not just about the current administration?
Well, you know, Donald Trump and Elon Musk are just individuals, right? There are some people supporting him as well. And so those people are just as dangerous as not, because if you took those two out of the equation, those people are not going to go away. So we have to make sure that we stay fast to our truths. We make sure that we fight for the right fight. And if we have to push back, if we have to throw a punch verbally, right, we do that, right? Because this is important to us.
I want to ask you about fundraising, because that was one area where Democrats have been doing fairly well over the last couple of cycles, especially compared to the state Republican Party. Are you confident you're going to be able to keep that up?
Oh, yeah, I'm confident. Especially now, since the way that, like I said, this administration is treating people, you know, tariff today, tariff tomorrow, no tariff. People are not satisfied or happy with that. And it takes action. And sometimes that action takes money. Right. And people are giving and people continue to give. They just want to make sure that their money is being well spent.
Well, so what's the thought process with that? Because obviously all the money that Democrats have raised hasn't translated into the kind of electoral success that I think a lot of Democrats were hoping for. So do you need to adjust the spending strategy or anything like that?
We just need to focus on where we can meet the people where they're at. Sometimes it's television, sometimes it's social media. We need to know our demographics and what the demographics we're trying to reach and meet them where they're at. That's the most important thing. And I think that will strengthen our position this next election cycle.
What has surprised you so far since taking this job?
I tell people this job is like getting a drink of water out of Niagara Falls.
Mm.
There's a lot coming at you. And, I have great support from my staff and I've had some mentors. But I think what surprised me is that the people's willingness to say, hey, it is time to fight. And I'm willing to lead that fight.
Do you think the Democrats didn't fight enough or haven't fought enough in the recent past?
We fight. I mean, we're fighting, and it's not always broadcasted. You don't always see it. But I think that we just have to realize that, you know what, we have to be better communicating our message, and people want to see us push back. And I'm not saying that we should be adversarial to the Republicans. I don't want to come across that way. I just want to know that, you know what, as a Democrat, you know, we tend to be the big tent party. And, you know, there's going to be some differences in opinions. But, you know, the one thing we have in common is that we're all American citizens, and we should be able to find common ground on that.
All right. That is Robert Branscombe, the new chair of the Arizona Democratic Party. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. It is increasingly rare for a TV series to break through the individualized algorithms of our feeds. But for the last few weeks, the Netflix series Adolescence has been generating widespread conversation. The show, which is fictional but filmed with documentary-style realism, tells the story of a 13-year-old high school boy named Jamie who murders a female classmate. Much of the series focuses on how shocked Jamie's family is to discover that he's capable of such violence. He's a good student who hasn't shown any obvious signs of trauma. But when investigators start looking into Jamie's social media history, they discover a troubling batch of Instagram posts, which seem to suggest that Jamie has been bullied by the girl he ends up killing. The third episode of the series presents an extended sequence in which Jamie is interviewed by a psychologist. At first, he's friendly and sweet. But when the psychologist starts asking probing questions about Jamie's family and his inner life, he explodes with rage, throwing objects around the room and screaming at the psychologist. When journalist Stephen Fried watched that scene, he was impressed. Fried has been covering teenage mental health for more than 40 years. In 1984, he published an influential piece of narrative nonfiction called Over the Edge, which documented the turbulent life of real-life teenagers in suburban Philadelphia. And Fried found the portrayal of teenage mental illness in adolescence to be fairly revolutionary. As he recently told my co-host Sam Dingman, he hopes viewers learn the right lesson from the series.
When you see a kid in this much pain, we always want to blame it on what's happening currently in society.
Right.
Because we don't have the words to suggest that the person has a diagnosable mental illness that could be treated.
Yeah.
So it's always, well, what are we going to do about X, Y, or Z? So when I first started writing about this in the 80s, it was, what are we going to do about boomboxes and cable TV and heavy metal music? And
right.
When we watch Adolescence, it's what are we going to do about social media and all these kinds of things? And all I would say is that, you know, let's make sure that we understand the difference between treatable mental illness and the delivery systems for the pressures of society.
Yeah, it's so interesting to me, those examples you cited, boomboxes, cable TV, and heavy metal music. Those are all things that, you know, whatever it is, 40-some years on now, seem, and tell me if you disagree, sort of quaint as far as social menaces go.
Yes.
So what did you make of the way that dynamic is presented in Adolescence? Because in your piece, Over the Edge, one of the things that you write about is the fact that these boys who ended up jumping to their deaths left behind these tapes that they had recorded where
yes.
They were on acid and they were kind of recording the monologues that were going through their minds as they prepared to do this. And it seemed like in the aftermath of their deaths, that was where a lot of the attention went. Was on the existence of these tapes, much the way in Adolescence as a lot of the attention amongst the investigators in the early going is on these Instagram posts and comments that Jamie and the other people in the story have been engaging in. Did you see an analogous situation in terms of the way that people perhaps focused on the wrong thing in the aftermath of the incidents in adolescence and in your piece?
Well, I think, first of all, we focus way too little on these cases, whether they are cases where people take their own lives or people who are just very seriously ill. And part of it is because they don't feel open to talk about it. So I don't blame people for being interested in the first thing that they find out about. Mm-hmm. I feel bad that they don't get the opportunity to find out more. I mean, when these young men took their own lives, of course, it was in the newspaper that they had jumped off a cliff and that there were tapes that they had left before they died. And it was my strange luck as a reporter to get them.
The tapes.
And yeah, somebody got them to me. And I had them, and I had to transcribe them. I had to transcribe 2 hours of incoherent, but sometimes incoherent talk, and then try to figure out what it was they were talking about. And one of the interesting things about adolescence, I will say, is that it's too bad that he killed somebody.
In the story.
Because I would have been equally interested in his rage if he hadn't. It is astonishing, and it's so amazing to see anybody pay this much attention to mental health and to really stay focused on it. I feel like in most cases in TV and movies, we get little glimpses of it, and then the camera goes away somewhere else. So I just thought it was fascinating and incredibly powerful and very scary. But at the same time, it made me realize, you know, normally the door closes.
Right.
These scenes, somebody screams at somebody and then the kid slams the door. Mm-hmm. I just think it's very rare, unfortunately, that a 13-year-old kid who's that upset gets to talk for that long and isn't interrupted and isn't allowed to leave.
Yeah.
And the question that we have to have as a society is, are we equally interested in that rage if it's not a murder?
Right.
But just a 13-year-old kid who's in real danger.
Well, I know that after you published the original version of Over the Edge, you did a follow-up where there was the suggestion that part of the rage of Mark Landis, who's the real-life teenager in your story, may have been that he had been sexually abused. And we don't get any information to that effect in adolescence in terms of what's going on with Jamie. But as you're saying, there is the sense that if people in his life had been listening a little bit more attentively to what was going on with him, they might have been able to intervene earlier. When you were watching that third episode, where the whole episode is basically this long exchange between Jamie and the psychologist.
Jamie, if you do not sit...
Look out! What does he do? You do not tell me when to sit down! You do not control what I do in my life!
Is everything okay? Jimmy.
I shouted. I'm sorry.
Was there anything Jamie said, based on your experience, that gave you the sense that there was more to the story than we hear about in a literal way?
Sure, there has to be. I mean, this is part of the problem. I mean, I think that we just assume that if you see somebody be open in that case, that that's everything. What Jamie did there is the beginning of a process, which sadly, because he's going to jail, is never going to be continued. And the question is whether you can see that kind of rage in somebody who needs help early enough so that they don't destroy their lives or take somebody else down with them. You know, part of me wants to know what the next interview with Jamie is like. If we care about Jamie enough to know what happens to him, it's not just like, what's the law and order version of it? Does he go to jail or not? You know, what else happened with him? Don't you want to know what happened to Jamie?
Absolutely.
Not whether he did it. I mean, we know he did it, right? There's a film.
Yeah, there's video. Whether he did it is the least interesting part of the story.
Learning about Jamie is a gift. For somebody to create a piece of art like this that matters about exploring this kid's head, I really hope that it doesn't get interpreted as being about social media and emojis. Every generation of kids has their own pressures and their own fears. And it is, you know, it's ridiculous for us to think that our version of it is better or different or worse.
So that makes me think of a line from the post that you wrote about this, where you said, mental illness adapts to the times, not the other way around.
People need to remind themselves of this all the time, because
right.
The question should be, what treatment is there for the Jamies of this world? Whether they have hurt somebody or they're about to hurt themselves, are we able to take care of them and to see, even when they scare the hell out of us, that they need treatment, that they need help?
Yeah.
You know, we make murder the other because it's easier for us than to think that it's something that people would do because their brains aren't working properly.
Yeah. Well, Stephen Fried is a journalist, a professor at Columbia and UPenn, the author of many books, and of course, the 1984 article Over the Edge. Stephen, thank you for this conversation.
Thanks so much, Sam. It was fascinating to talk to you.
That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.